dynamic duo show. Right here at GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm on here every Monday and Friday. Co-host Dr. James Fetzer comes on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. Today I'm going to be talking about literature, but not just any old literature. I think I'll be talking to two of the very best writers in the 9/11 truth movement. In fact, you know, you could make a case that they are the best. I don't want to be, you know, playing favorites here or anything or putting down anybody. I think they're a whole lot of good writers. But I'm talking to two of my favorites, people who have a real style of their own and who have been eloquent in their defense of 9/11 truth. By way of fiction, in the case of my first hour guest, his name is Mike Polacek. Now, Mike has written quite a few books. I think he's pushing 10, not quite there yet. I think of Mike as kind of a Midwestern Kilgore Trout. Kilgore Trout was, of course, Kurt Vonnegut's alter ego, although actually I think he was based on Philip Jose Farmer or some other science fiction writer, but Kilgore Trout was this guy who was writing stuff that was just too good to be published for the small readership that he had. He actually had to publish in magazines with dirty pictures. Fortunately, Mike Polacek hasn't had to do that yet, but he is one of those people who has something to say, and he's not being promoted onto the New York Times bestseller list. I can't imagine why that would be, given that his last couple of books are increasingly powerful 9/11 truth driven sardonic visions of what has happened to this country. And that is actually the same kind of theme that we get from my second hour guest, Eric Larson. Both Mike and Eric are telling the truth, not just about 9/11, but also some deeper truth about where we are in terms of our national soul at this point in history. And it ain't pretty, folks, but the language that Mike and Eric use to express their respective visions is, well, if not pretty, at least pretty well worked, pretty well chiseled. These guys know what they're doing. Take it from me. I've been studying literature for years. I have 4 advanced degrees in literature. These guys are good. All right, well, let's bring on Mike. He's the author of Guests of the Nation is his most recent book. Guests of the Nation, he told me, was kind of inspired by a weird thing that happened to me last year at the airport in New Jersey, flying home from a 9/11 truth conference. That got Mike's imagination going a bit, and he's produced a really intense, over-the-top, sardonic, hilarious, yet awful vision based on a sort of an imaginative recreation of what might have really happened on 9/11. Without further ado, let's let him speak for himself for once. Welcome, Mike Polacek. How are you, Mike?
Kevin, how are you doing? Good. I'm doing good.
Hey, great. Yeah, well, you know, I love your stuff, Mike. You've got your own vision. Like Vonnegut, you got a sardonic, deceptively simple style all your own. You've really taken it to the limit with Guests of the Nation. I have to take my hat off to you for that book.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for the inspiration.
Well, yeah, you know, it's when I first read your manuscript, after you told me that you wanted to base this on my article, I finally made the no-fly list, which came out last, or was it the, I finally made the slow-fly list, I guess it was.
That
came out a year ago. And I wasn't quite sure what you were going to do with that, but oh boy, you picked it up and ran with it.
Well, it's just Guests of the Nation. The title, I guess you can read a lot of things into the title. You could take it a lot of different ways. But for me, I wanted to borrow from Frank O'Connor's short story, Guests of the Nation. And it's about Frank O'Connor's short story, if I have that right, is about in the 1930s, some Irish soldiers are holding some British soldiers captured, and they become friends. And in the end, they part ways real tragically. And that's how I thought of the title when I used it. Other people have seen different ways to tie the title into the story.
Yeah, I could imagine a few others myself. You know, I'm glad when I parted ways with those FBI agents in real life, it wasn't quite that tragic. They actually ended up being pretty friendly at the very end and wishing me luck in getting my job back after I'd been blackballed from academia for speaking out for 9/11 truth. But your book is actually better than my real life story.
Well, the FBI agents in my story are not the bad guys.
That's right.
They're the good guys. Yeah. I don't know if I should tell it all, but
no, let's not give away the whole story.
They're not the evil doers in the story.
Right, and that's, I think, that's true in real life, too, that the vast majority of FBI agents are decent, hardworking, honest, patriotic people. As Colleen Rowley, one of the rare ones who's been willing to put her head on the chopping block, has pointed out to me. I've had her on the show, and she's, you know, she actually, I think, has a Pollyanna-ish view of the FBI. She says, for example, that any whistleblowers should just head for the FBI office and they'll probably be okay. I think that might be pushing it a little bit, but the larger picture is that the troops, the cops, the FBI, they're not all bad people.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't know that many personally anymore, but that could be true. Is Colleen Rowley, is she still running for Congress, or is that past? Is that years past?
No, that was I think that was it 2004, 2006. One of those two was when she made her run, and she's still pretty active in the Twin Cities, though, doing activism. I get her newsletter and kind of try to keep up on her exploits. She's been big with the anti-war movement, and she's come closer and closer to embracing the full 9/11 truth inside job thesis over the years. She was not quite willing to go there a couple of years ago when I first had her on the show, and lately I guess she's talked to some folks, including peace studies professor Michael Andreg, who works up there in the Twin Cities, and he's fully hip to 9/11, and he tells me that she's kind of coming along there, but yeah, she's a
good
person. Go ahead.
Her name was on in passing. Her name, I noticed her name was on. I asked the FBI for information on the Peltier case one time, and I was looking over those papers. I just noticed that her name was, she was the agent who had sent those to me a few years ago, quite a few years ago.
Oh, really? She sent you the papers, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to contact the agent's family to try and get, I was a journalist doing a story on it, and I was trying to get in contact with the family, and she was kind of the go-between.
Ah, interesting connection there. Yeah, well, I have a lot of admiration for her, and frankly, despite the utterly ridiculous nature of my own interrogation by the FBI, I ended up not feeling that bad about these particular individuals. I think that there are a lot of places and cases in history where people get mistreated worse by national police than I got mistreated.
And was it because of something you were wearing or something? Or somewhere they know that you had been? Is that why it was? Or?
Well, no, it was because they, I had been flying out there to give a talk, and I left a notebook in the plane when I got off, and it had Arabic writing in it.
And I remember now.
Yeah, a notebook with Arabic writing. Let's get this guy. We'll be back in a bit. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking to Mike Polacek, author of Guests of the Nation and many other great books. Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today I'm talking literature with two of the very best 9/11 truth fiction writers, Mike Polacek in the first hour, bringing on Eric Larson in the second hour. Well, Mike, you know, one of the great things about Guests of the Nation, on top of its, you know, its really nice punchy style and wry, dark humor, is it delves a little bit into this issue of psychological complicity with 9/11. You know, I think the whole country, and, you know, maybe even more than just the whole country, in a sense, is complicit by, you know, not being willing to go there, not being willing to expose it. But even those of us who have gone there and who have tried to expose it have to sort of think from the perspective of the people that did it in order to grasp what was really done. And doing that, in a sense, makes you feel kind of complicit. You know, you put yourself in the shoes of these guys who said, well, the American Empire, you know, is not going to last another 100 years unless we follow this particular path of expanding our imperial mobilization and doubling our military budget and so on and so forth, and, you know, and put yourself in the shoes of the Israelis who are facing possible, you know, possible end of their nation in the not too distant future, or at least a transformation that they don't want. And so you have to put yourself in the shoes of the guilty people to understand what happened. And I think your book really gets into that in a way that not much else that I've read does.
Well, I can't help but think about that. I think, you know, if these guys really did this, if Karl Rove and George Bush and Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and all those folks, if they really were involved in this as we think they were, as I'm coming to believe they were, you know, how, when we see them on TV or in a, you know, public appearance and they're just normal, they're just making jokes and they're able to, you know, go about their daily routine. I just think that's very interesting. I guess I have to ask myself, how do they do that? And I haven't solved it, but I just have to wonder about that. And if you've participated in the killing of so many and such a big lie that you have to live with for the rest of your life, I mean, how does that affect you? I think that's just fascinating. I truly don't have the answer, but I think that question is a big one. How do you deal with that yourself?
Yeah, and you do sort of work on that in the book. It's you're kind of chewing on that problem, and it's really very enlightening and interesting to imaginatively think that way. Of course, it's also painful, and you know, I think your book is a good example of sort of painful wry humor, or, you know, somewhat like gallows humor. You know, where did you get that vision? It's not just this book, but some of your other books also have something that, you know, I'd call it some kind of dark humor. Have you always seen the world that way?
I don't. Maybe I'm. You know, I guess. Yeah, I guess it's what's inside of me. I came through this writing thing through seminary and then through the peace movement and then prison, and in prison. At prison and county jail, I just totally hit the wall. I mean, I was just a basket case after a while. I mean, I just deeply depressed. And so that kind of, maybe that colors my world vision. And I'm, as I come out of it, I'm beginning to see, you have to laugh and you have to just keep going. And I'm, you know, after, well, it's been since 1989. I got out of jail the last time. It was 6 months in the Council Bluffs, Iowa County Jail for an off-at Air Force Base action. But but since then, you know, it's almost 20 years now. But I remember all that, and I can laugh now, and I try to. I think it's important. You can't be. You have to remember. You have to know what's going on in the world. But you can't be so darn serious all the time. So I guess that's what I try to do.
Well, laughter can be a pretty good defense mechanism against pain, unlike some other defense mechanisms like drugs and alcohol or acting out or denial. Yeah. Humor seems to sort of exercise it. It gives you a bit of a catharsis. And you know, that's one of the things I really admire about Jewish culture. You know, I mean, I've been attacked, like Wikipedia, you know, says Barrett, you know, Barrett has very questionable views about Jews and Zionism. But the fact is I actually have a somewhat, you know, positive bias towards Jewish culture, which has survived down through the years in very difficult circumstances, in part thanks to a certain kind of humor, and, you know, black humor, gallows humor, the kind of humor that helps you cope with suffering is pretty well developed in the Jewish community, or so it seems to me, based on my own interactions with friends and things that I've learned. And in some cases, you know, while studying black humor in college. And I think we need that kind of humor in the 9/11 truth movement because, you know, God knows we have enough suffering between what we know and how the people around us treat us when we speak the truth.
Yeah, yeah. And humor can be a good weapon too. I use it sometimes as ridicule and ridicule to attack the powerful. I do that in Iowa Terror, and I don't know if I'd use it quite as much in Guess the Nation, but as a writer, you don't have, you know, you're sitting home with your pen or your computer and you feel pretty powerless, and I guess what you have is, you know, I think humor is one of the most powerful things you do have.
Well, sure. It also can really deflate pretension, which is why you get that kind of humor that attacks the powerful, especially in totalitarian or real authoritarian societies. The old Soviet Union was, you know, a real hotbed of that kind of humor. And now we're getting more and more of it in the USA as our, you know, normal political serious discourse is dumbed down and it's censored. And, you know, there isn't really any, you know, honest discourse at all in the official media. So we have to sort of go samizdat and go underground and tell the horrible truth with that grain of humor that punctures the pretensions of the leadership.
You know, Jon Stewart and Colbert, they use that, but I always wonder when I'm watching them, I know they're not going to talk about 9/11, and I always wonder why. I mean, you know, they'll go a certain ways, and those guys are funny, but you know, just like it. Just won't hear some things from them. I just wonder why.
Well, you know, I wish that Colbert, when he was roasting Bush that time where he just went off on Bush right in his presence,
yeah.
I wish he'd gone all the way and done 9/11. Now, you know, that would have been better than that scene from V for Vendetta where the comedian goes all out in roasting the leader. Anyway, we'll be back. And this is Kevin Durant with Mike Olichek. Stick around.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help, when I was younger, so much younger than today. I never needed anybody's help in any way.
The Dynamic Duo Show. This is GCNLive.com, and I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Mike Polichek, author of Guests of the Nation, the most recent of his novels. It does concern 9/11. It actually presents a scenario of what might have happened on 9/11, which is something that we're often warned about, and we're told, well, we should really just talk about how the official story is impossible, rather than trying to flesh out an alternative scenario. But every once in a while, you have to do that, especially if you're a fiction writer. And Mike has done a great job, probably the most impressive job yet, of fleshing out such a scenario. And it is grueling and hair-raising and quite often very, very funny as well. Well, Mike, you know, in terms of that question of the psychology of the people that did 9/11, whether the people at the top, like Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Bush, and so on, or the people who were parts of the operational level of it, how can they live with themselves afterwards? You know, what kind of people are they? What's it like to be that kind of a person in that kind of a situation? We just got some fresh information on a kind of a similar case. Just, I think it was yesterday, that this videotape of E. Howard Hunt talking about his role in the CIA-organized JFK assassination was released. You can find that at RadioDuJour.com. If you don't speak French, that's RadioDuJour.com. And, well, you know, I don't know. Have you seen that, Mike, or have you heard anything about the Howard Hunt confession? It's quite fascinating.
Well, was it in Playboy or Rolling Stone? It was
Rolling Stone,
Rolling
yeah.
Stone. And I heard about it back then. That's been, and I read the book. I've been to his son's website, and I have heard about it, but I didn't know about yesterday's, whatever came out yesterday.
Yeah, it's the videotaped version. So you get to actually, you know, watch Hunt while he explains this to his son. And, you know, here we have a guy who was, as he says, a bench warmer in the big event, which was the CIA code name for the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, describing how Johnson was a key player, how the operational head was Cord Meyer, who was the head of the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, which is a division of the CIA that attempts to control the media. And there were some other key people, too, including David Morales, probably very likely one of the trigger men in that hit, as well as the Bobby Kennedy hit. He bragged about both. He was the CIA's top Latin America assassin. So Howard Hunt is, you know, you see him. Now you can actually see his face as he talks about this. And it's just, yeah, go ahead.
Can you see it online? Do you have to?
Go to RadioDuJour.com and you can watch it. Ed of Radio DuJour has already posted it. It came out of, I believe, Prison Planet. Alex Jones broke this video story. And yeah, here's a guy who's done something, involved in doing something that most of us would regard as extremely heinous. You know, murdering the President of the United States. For what reason? Well, he's too much of a peacenik. He's in the way of an ambitious, criminal, psychopathic vice president who wants to get to the top. These are really not very good reasons for, you know, murdering the president if you're part of an intelligence agency that's, you know, sworn to uphold the Constitution. So, you know, how do people like Hunt live with this? And if you look at Hunt's confessions to his son, you can see that Hunt sort of justified it because Johnson was sort of legitimate in terms of chain of command. he didn't feel that bad about it, but you could see he felt a little bad about it. You know, he says, well, you know, this wasn't really a very good day for democracy or something like that. But anyway, you know, it kind of does stretch your mind to, you know, to put yourself in the place of these people.
And that he was able to deny it for all these years, I guess that tells us something about what took to, you know, when we see the faces of the people we're accusing today.
Right, and what's interesting about Hunt is he had to deny it under attack this whole time because, you know, people have known that he was involved in it. I mean, he's been identified as one of the guys on the grassy knoll with the hearing aids, you know, the hobos with the hearing aids that got taken in by the Dallas police and interrogated and then released with no records. That was him and Sturgis, apparently. And you know, the researchers have been after him for decades now, and he kept denying it. He actually sued Mark Lane for slander or libel or whatever because Mark Lane had said something about this. And Lane won the case on the basis of truth, that is, telling the truth that Hunt was part of a CIA operation to kill the president. very few people realize that there's an actual jury verdict to that effect. But, yeah, Hunt just kept lying the whole time.
James Douglas has a great book, too. I just finished that JFK. Was it The Truth Revealed?
Right.
I just felt like I waited my whole life to read that book when I was reading it. It was just, And I can't wait till the next book, RFK, and also about Martin King and Malcolm. Those are coming up soon.
It's great book.
I was in Dallas on a last book tour. I was this spring. I was promoting Iowa Terror and another book. But I, you know, just being there was, you know, it's like for somebody like me, the first time it's like you just cannot believe you're there. It's like being at the 50-yard line of Lambeau Field for me or something like that. But I went behind the grassy or the fence there, and I saw written on the fence there, it was St. John Hunt was there, was here and had a date, and I think he said LBJ did it. And I was communicated with St. John Hunt by email, and I asked if that was really his signature. He said, yeah, he couldn't help but do that. He'd been there not too long before that.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Good for him. I mean, it's really, he's performed a service, for history by getting his dad to talk. And, you know, you can see that Hunt was not completely inhuman. You know, I think these psychopaths who rise to the top of these military and intelligence hierarchies are not complete, you know, lone nut psychopaths, like the kind that get locked up or, you know, serial killers or whatever. These are psychopaths who can work with other people, especially people who are largely psychopathic, but they still, you know, they have a shred of humanity. And Hunt clearly felt bad about his botched relationship with his son, and this confession was sort of a last gift to his son. So there's an interesting sort of human angle there. You see that you know, here's a guy who can have enough humanity to want to offer this confession to his son, who really wants to get this information, and yet he's also inhuman enough not only to have done this, but to have just kept on denying it through the decades.
And we have to wait to see if humanity can win out over so-called duty and money in the 9/11 case. We need some more whistleblowers.
Well, I still have high hopes. I think that there must be a lot of people who were involved in various ways, especially people who were not really directly consciously complicit, who would like nothing better than to come forward and tell the truth. You know, Stanley Hilton, who you quoted in this book, who's kind of a dubious source in some ways, but, you know, who knows? I mean, he says there were many dozens of military people that he was in touch with who wanted a chance to come forward and tell the truth in court. And, you know, he says there was some kind of executive order signed by Bush authorizing 9/11. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But undoubtedly, there are a lot of people who would like to be able to talk if they were safe and protected in a legal venue. And I hope that will come along soon. That situation would be really, really interesting. We'll be back in a bit. Kevin Barrett here with Mike Polacek, author of Guests of the Nation. And your website, Mike, is MikePolacek.com?
Yeah, the last name is P-A-L-E-C-E-K.
Okay, and we're not done yet, so we'll say that again at the end of the show. We'll be right back in a bit.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
Welcome back. This is the Dynamic Duo Show. You're listening to GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking today with two of the best 9/11 truth fiction writers out there. Mike Polacek is my first hour guest. Coming on in the second hour will be Eric Larson at ericlarson.net, L-A-R-S-E-N. These guys are very good at chiseling words. They have unique visions, and they're both hardcore 9/11 truth tellers. Mike Polacek is the author of the new book, Guests of the Nation. And Mike, it comes to mind that you know, we're kind of in similar situations as 9/11 truth tellers and as writers, especially a writer like yourself who keeps cranking out books, book after book. You're up to what, 8 now?
I'm not sure. I think, 8, 9, something like that.
Yeah, and these are, you know, you're not making huge amounts of money on this, to be a writer who's expressing a unique vision that is not necessarily going to be fully understood and accepted and embraced by every one of your neighbors, it must take a certain kind of persistence to do that, just as it takes a certain kind of persistence to keep on telling the truth about 9/11 in the face of many reactions from people who don't really get that either. What keeps you going? What kind of relationship do you have with your audience and with your community that kind of sustains you as a writer with a unique vision and a truth teller telling truths that a lot of people just aren't going to get right away?
Well, I don't know. I guess what sustains me is I can't stop. I mean, I think when you're a writer, it's like being a Catholic. You can try to quit, but you can't walk away from it. Because it's in you. I don't know. It's just a lot of times I'll say, well, that was that after the last book. That's enough. And then I'll be riding around the car and I'll have more notes. And pretty soon I'll want to try it one more time. And I've got two ready to come out next year. And I'm working on a series for the 2010. I don't know. It's kind of like going to prison. Because, you know, a lot of people will say, right, and for no pay. And people will say, well, what good did that do? And,
well, it's more interesting than license plates.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was like going to prison, too, for civil disobedience. They might say, well, you know, did you do any good? I said, well, I don't know if I did or not, but I had to do it, you know. And there was some good to that. It was worth something. It was worth a whole lot to me, and I just hope it. In the end, it turns out that it is worth something. And so you know, it's just like with anybody's life's work. You just keep, whether it's making shoes or whatever, you just keep doing it. One of your intros was, saying, you know, the Beatles, those Beatles intros are great. And one of them was about you wanting a revolution. And, sometimes people will talk about we need a new American revolution. And I don't want to go there about regarding guns or whatever, but a cultural revolution, you know, I would love to see, and this is almost boring because it would take years and years, but just an awakening, you know, before you would have any real change in America, I think you'd have to have an awakening, like a new enlightenment. And I just hope that those of us who are writing books today can contribute in some way to the opening of the eyes of the American people, whether it be this year or the next decade or the next after that, but somewhere it's got to start where we just start walking around with blinders on all the time. I think that's where it has to begin.
Well, I wonder what an American awakening would look like at this point. Do you think possibly an economic catastrophe, which seems to be what we're walking into, could lead people to place less emphasis on going through the motions to go after material goods and maybe stay home a little more and actually read books? I mean, that's like the only thing I can think of that could possibly do it.
Sad to say, yes. I think, you know, one reason that people, the American people don't want to do anything about 9/11 or about war is because we're all too comfortable, that it doesn't affect our daily lives. But when it affects our daily lives, then we'll do something. And maybe it takes a crisis like that. I don't know. Like when the city council tells you to put in a sidewalk and you don't want to, well, that's the time you go to that city council meeting and you learn everything there is about the city council. So when it affects you, when it's your son going to Iraq instead of just your neighbors, or when it affects your pocketbook, or when it, you know, when you feel like it affects you, you know, on my website I have a link to Bob McElvain, and I just, listening to him, you know, it affected him deeply. It was his son. And I just try and tell people that, you know, that, I don't know, it's that important. It is happening. You know, it isn't just somewhere else. It's happening. And, I don't know, it is something to get very excited about. It's real and it's happening and it's important. It is very important.
Well, Bob McElvain is somebody who's affected me, very much. I still remember when that creep, Steve Lemons or whatever his name was, out in the Arizona 9/11 Truth Conference a year and a half or two ago, really viciously insulted Bob at the press conference. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that just, you know, really makes it a stark contrast between the truth tellers, especially a truth teller like Bob, who's been through hell, and the enemies of the truth tellers.
Is this guy a journalist? I don't know him. Steve Lemons?
This is a anti 9/11 truth journalist who's, you know, cranked out a bunch of hit pieces back in late 2006 during the period when they were still attacking us. You know, they spent maybe half a year attacking us rather than ignoring us, thinking that might make us go away. It didn't. Anyway, talking about the way being personally affected by these things makes all the difference. I've noticed that in my Congress campaign. And that's something you've done too. You've run for Congress. You know, trying to get people hip to 9/11 is an uphill battle. We do have 22% in the district among the households with two or more voters where one of them has voted recently. You know, conservative plugged into the system households. 22% say that 9/11 might have been an inside job, which is pretty amazing in this rural conservative district. But about 80% say bail out the people, not the bankers. And the, you know, opposition to the banker bailout is very, very strong because people realize that this is going to, you know, steal tens of thousands of dollars from their households over the future. Hopefully that will spark some popular resistance.
How's your campaign going?
Well, it's moving right along. You know, I don't have enough money to blanket the media with advertising, which would be the one way to really, you know, make a big potential dent. But I've definitely got a seed planted among people in this rural third district of Wisconsin, and I think that seed is going to be growing for a while.
Yeah. That, you know, even if by some chance you're not elected, that you, know,
how could
you
that
are
happen?
Doing. I don't know, but you are doing a lot of good. I mean, I've seen some of the emails you sent out, and you have a real creative approach to it, and it's great. And I know that it is fun to try it like that. I imagine you're getting some enjoyment out of it. It's fun to be trying.
Well, it sure has its moments. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, any other kind of work. Only in this case, there's this. You know, it feels like there's quite a lot riding on it. You know, there are, you know, a lot of lives riding on whether we turn away from war and put our resources towards, you know, making things that people actually can use and that sustain people rather than kill them. That's a fairly major task. When was the last time you ran for Congress, Mike?
It was in 2000. I was the Democratic candidate for Western Iowa District, the 5th District. And I don't know what it was. I got 65,000 votes, but that, you know, I don't know. It was
that's
a year,
pretty good.
That's just,
yeah.
Or if that's, one thing I did, I don't know if you, I bought this vinyl sign on an old pickup and put the sign over the pickup and just drove around the district. I don't know if you didn't have any money either, but.
Well, my pickup broke down. The electrical system burned up. Plus, it only gets about 6 miles a gallon.
Congrats for that, then.
That's why I'm driving a smaller car. But, yeah, I guess we're at the end of the road here, Mike, for this show. But, hey, thanks for coming on. You're always a lot of fun to talk to, and your books are great. Give us your website again.
It's Mike Palacek. It's Mike, PALECEK.com.
Okay. Guess
thank
the
you, Kevin,
is
very much.
Book. Well, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Good luck to you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
That was Mike Palacek, PALECEK. Of MikePalacek.com. We'll be back in a bit with Eric Larson, another really good writer. Just a moment.
Turning by my guitar, checking.
Welcome back to hour number two of today's edition of the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett. Today I'm talking with two of the very best writers in the 9/11 truth movement, people who have used their considerable linguistic skills not only to write superb fiction, but also to tell the truth about politics. It's interesting when that can go together, and, you know, it doesn't always. You know, there's some of the people who are so politically committed that that's all they think about produce mediocre fiction. That has happened before. I guess the Soviet Union used to have some people like that on the government payroll. My guests today are on the opposite extreme. They're good writers, and my second hour guest, Eric Larson, is way off on that opposite extreme. He's somebody who is quite amazingly ambitious and really, really good as a fiction writer, who's also a master of angry journalistic prose aimed at everything that's wrong with the USA in its current manifestation. And boy, there's quite a bit that's wrong, and I don't know of a social critic who is more worth paying attention to than Eric Larson. If you're not on his newsletter list, sign up now. You can find him at ericlarson.net. Eric just recently was finally able to publish his novel, The End of the 19th Century. He collected a bunch of rejection letters that read like rave reviews. They all pretty much said, wow, this is stunning. This is so good that the poor American sheeple will never understand it, so we can't make any money off it. Please go find another publisher. And he finally ended up getting it published with the help of my good friend John at Progressive Press, one of the more important publishers out there these days, and I don't say that just because they publish my own Truth Jihad, but they're also Webster Tarpley's publisher, and Webster is, of course, one of the most important geopolitical thinkers out there. So I think it's a great day for literature when Eric Larson finally gets this novel published, and I'm in the middle of it, and I am pleased to say it is a very wonderful, wonderful novel. You want to savor it. I hadn't read Eric's fiction before, I'm ashamed to admit, and now I have an even deeper appreciation for my guest, Eric Larson. So, hey, welcome, Eric, and congratulations on getting that book out there.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. It's great to hear you again, and awfully nice to hear those words. I can't be more grateful. Yeah, the book is up and out. It's a couple little editing things still going on, but there it is. It's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, all of those rave rejections, I don't get rave reviews, but rave rejections, they're true, in a sense, indeed. They couldn't make money from my book, not this one. And in certain cases, they're fairly grieved about that. One of the it was this case, it was a publisher-editor who was having to reject it, and he said, I'm terribly disappointed in myself.
Well, he should be.
I guess so.
I mean, the guy, he probably studied English and, you know, read all kinds of great literature and goes to work and he, you know, gets a bunch of crap and has to reject it and some mediocre stuff that he can sell and he accepts it. And then he gets your book, which is, you know, more the kind of stuff he was trained to appreciate in college, and he feels like he has to reject it. Oh, boy, you know, what's the point of following that kind of career trajectory?
Yes, you do wonder, and I think indeed the problem is well, I'm tongue-tied because there's so many elements in that question or that statement. It seems to me that the literary cultural and the general cultural situation in the U.S. right now is at a real nadir, and it's a commoned out, and it's essentially a boring and highly simplified culture. And it's because nobody has found a way. Now, maybe this, you know, the kind of publishing that John is doing may help, and it may help a great, great deal. But when you have serious publishers like Knopf and Farrar, Straus, and Giroux hooked to the bottom line in exactly the same degree and in exactly the same qualities as cheaper presses, then you don't have anything that you could still call a high culture. The very term high culture is fairly non-acceptable. But what do we do without a higher, at least, culture? And I don't think that any republic, any free republic, can be healthy or hale without a higher culture. It just won't work.
People who've lived in unfree countries sometimes come here. This happened with a lot of literary types from Russia.
Yes.
And they find themselves almost thinking that it was better there, because at least the brainwashing apparatus was resisted by intelligent people who did put their hearts into it and created a sort of oppositional high culture. Whereas here, there's not a whole lot of informed resistance.
There's very little, if any, informed resistance. Kevin Barrett, a fellow I know, is one of the informed resistors. But without any question, what you just said is true. This is back in 1976, and the other John Leonard, the New York Times John Leonard, wrote a piece called Stop, I Want to Get Off the Train. And it was he and Hilton Kramer had written pieces, both of which made it clear that they thought American writing, and this is way long ago, was not up to snuff with that of the Soviet writers and the dissidents, because the Americans didn't have enough to write about. And underneath that argument was that torture is good, and suppression, oppression is good. And
it sure gave Mike Polachek something to write about. I don't know if you've read his new book, but
I have just ordered. He made a sale while you were talking with him.
Hey, okay.
Yeah, I sent for it. Yeah. So I'm eager to see it, because Iowa Terror was just wonderfully just, you want him to say more, but you want to keep reading and you want to keep watching, and it's really quite, it's visually enormously entertaining stuff.
Right.
Plus the political element, which I'm very eager to hear. I was happy to hear him mention the Frank Conroy story. That's an awful story. It's just a beautiful piece of sorrow and tragedy.
This, and Guest of the Nation kind of is too.
Yeah.
His suffering has given him something to write about. And you too, in a different vein. The end of the 19th century anybody who says that there's nothing in American life to write about should take a look at this.
Oh, thank you. That's very helpful, really. Yeah, because I was just reading here, thinking about talking with you, and in the paper yesterday, there was a piece on the front page that ran inside called Urban Fiction. As graphic as the street finds a place in libraries. And it's about librarians who are helping promote reading by promoting this, what they're calling now, urban fiction. And it's just, bodice rippers and drug deals and hardcore Mickey Spillane kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it being done on self-publishing sites. And I suppose that's a good thing. There's this one woman who's central in the article, and she's forces her kids to read 1 hour a night from 5 to 6 o'clock, no matter what. She doesn't care what they read, so long as they read. She herself reads 5 books a week. And that's great, except I find her then saying, here's a quote from her, "I read what I can relate to," she said. They're writing in these books about what I've experienced. And that's not a very helpful way to look at art of any kind. And by that measure, I can't appreciate Joseph Conrad because I was never a mariner.
Mm-hmm.
Or Shakespeare, because I was never a courtier.
Right. Well, I did live sort of down and out on the streets of San Francisco
yes.
for quite a while, and I met some of these down and out type writers who cover the seamy side of the urban jungle.
Right.
But at a certain point, you long for something deeper than that. We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett with Eric Larson. Welcome back to the USSA. The Samizdat is still cranking on the internet, and we're working on bringing some perestroika and some glasnost into this closing society.
Yeah. I'm reading Webster Tarpley's new Obama book, And he's a deep scholar. He's an incredibly widely read man, far more than I ever understood from reading Synthetic Terror, though at the time, I suppose it's just so long now that I had forgotten how learned he is. But you know, the entire question of dumbing down in that book is the central thesis.
Really? And, you know, I haven't read that one yet. I did read the first one, the Postmodern Coup.
Right. Yeah, you said you thought well of it. I certainly did. I thought he did it in obvious haste because the end of it, the last third, is not as highly unified as the rest.
Right.
Yeah, and I forgive that easily. This one is an immense amount of work. It's extraordinarily detailed, and the thesis is very simple, and it's that the candidates, and particularly Obama, are groomed by foundations, and it's the foundations, the sort of left foundations, in particular the Ford Foundation in the case of Obama, that have really cultivated the entire downslide of cultural alertness and consequently also of political unity. And they took a cue in the beginning from Nixon and his Secretary Schultz. Was he state or what was he?
Schultz, yeah, state, I think.
Yeah, and he came up with something that they called the Philadelphia Plan. In a nutshell, it was to divide and conquer in order to keep the opposition against the Republicans fragmented. And they did it through essentially things like affirmative action, which at that point began to grow, as did multiculturalism and diversity. And these elements, these ideas, which of course changed life in academia, I was there, I saw it change in the 70s and 80s. In fact, I wrote a book about how it changed. And I never realized, though, that these things, these dividers, so that Hispanics would be quarreling against blacks and gays would be quarreling against, you know, Chicani, and it was just falling apart. This all came from places like McGeorge Bundy. They would single out do good, you know, liberal left, socially conscious on the surface, grants, and give them to groups that were tiny and never could succeed in themselves, and that would cause them to be pitted against other groups of their same socioeconomic level.
And right, so it's a divide and conquer strategy.
Absolutely, and divide by race, not
right.
by class.
Right.
And that's it's a profound book.
Yeah, well, that's what's been done also at the level of the culture wars, as you've written about.
Yeah.
The conservative cultural values people are cut off from the more liberal cultural values people by these hot button issues of abortion and so on and family values. And all of that creates a huge ruckus and diverts people's attention away from the issues of, you know, who has the power and, you know, how are they using it to determine the quality of life of you.
Of you. They are all diversionary tactics. And I saw that, I guess, maybe in the middle 90s, and I realized it. And I realized, too, that my own aims and ambitions as a writer, you know, my own having a place or a spot or a role or something I could achieve in the culture had been really blown out of the water by this. There was not any longer a literary cultural atmosphere or set of shared assumptions that I had with anybody else.
You know, it's kind of ironic that you've caught this from sort of a diametrically opposed position from that of the neoconservatives, and yet you hear something sort of superficially similar from the neoconservatives when they get on their, you know, ranting about American culture and the evil liberals who've destroyed it. Some of those people actually are onto something when they talk about the loss of a common culture.
Oh, yeah, and you know, I don't think neoliberalism, the neocons couldn't have come into existence as they have if this foundation supported fracturing of the liberal mind hadn't preceded it. I remember I was in talking with one of my colleague who's a very closest friend I still have from the days when I was teaching, and he said one day I was lamenting the left and the positions it was taking and how it was becoming more like a police action. You had to do this, and this, and think this way. And it was all political correctness stuff. And he said, yes, the left is committing suicide. And that metaphor has stayed with me since. But now I realize that they weren't committing suicide. They were allowing themselves to be murdered by
by
the financier plutocracy and the foundation powers. If only Tarpley could get, you know, I'm racing. I'm three-fourths of the way through this book. I'm reviewing it, and I think, you know, there's a race between me and November 4th, as if that would have any effect. But it's a powerhouse.
Well, I was just on Webster's show today.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. He's on this very network at noon.
Mm-hmm.
And, he goes head-to-head with Alex Jones, so you have to be pretty formidable to do that. So, yeah, I was on there, and we were talking about how the next, you know, the big issue that's shaping up is this, call it what you want, resistance or liberation struggle against this incipient financier dictatorship.
That's right. And it, incipient is indeed not an erroneous word to use. Webster, he's talking about, there's a phrase, I was just reading that part of it at lunch, but, Election Day could be a really huge turning point. Not for reasons that people think, not at all, but because this form, this new order is going to be implemented.
Right. Well, you know, I can see how you've caught on to this a lot faster than many people have, by virtue of your, you know, intellectual path. Your book, A Nation Gone Blind, mm-hmm. traced this process of destroying the left, by affirmative action here and, dividing people into these little groups to fight against each other there and dumbing them all down and imposing mediocrity and so on. And as I drive around Madison, Wisconsin, which is where I am right now, and see all these Obama signs and Obama bumper stickers, your book is prophetic. It's a, you know, science fiction nightmare that's come true.
Two things. One, I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know where it was coming from. I didn't know who. I didn't know this, what I know now from reading Tarpley. I knew it was happening, but I thought it was being brought upon the academic people, for example, themselves. But no, coming from a high. But the other thing is, you know, the Obama buttons, what they're like? They're like the flags after 9/11. Everywhere.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, cutting a little too close to the bone there. That's Eric Larson. We'll be back for some more talk in a few minutes. So stick around, folks. This is Kevin Barrett, barrettforcongress.us. We shall return.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
GCNLive.com. This is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to the Dynamic Duo Show, and today I've interviewed a couple of superb paperback writers, Mike Polacek in the first hour, and now Eric Larson, whose literary talents are now really blowing me away that I've sat down and actually read some of his fiction. And, you know, Eric, I'm not sure where to start there. I could talk to you pretty much till the cows come home. but getting back to this issue of the foundation funding of the destruction of American liberal culture. We were talking in the first hour a little bit about Howard Hunt, who's recently his videotaped confession to having participated in the CIA hit on JFK.
Yeah.
Just came out yesterday. And, did you know that Hunt actually personally bought the rights to Animal Farm from Orwell's widow in the early 50s on behalf of the CIA? They had a front foundation, but that was actually a CIA front. He went and actually purchased the rights to Animal Farm from Orwell's widow. This is, you couldn't get a better vignette to illustrate exactly what's going on in this culture.
Can you imagine? George Orwell himself, Eric Blair, would have enjoyed and appreciated every single irony in that whole story.
Yeah, he would have wished he could have written that.
it's an appalling thing. I'm eager to hear the Howard Hunt or see the video you mentioned on the Radio du Jour. You said I could.
That's right, RadioDuJour.com,
yeah.
RadioDuJour.com. A highly recommended website that is kind of the best of alternative radio. I actually get my shows on there every once in a while. So, and the commercials are gone, but except for, you know, a little commercial for the network it comes from.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of it's whetting people's appetite for listening to GCN day and night, which is what they should be doing, of course.
Of course. Yeah.
But,
yeah. Well, I tell you, this is a hard battle. My old colleagues, and I have plenty of other people too, I suppose, those not the ones that I probably talk to anymore, I think I'm a real troglodyte conservative. And that became the case. I'd had a really blissful first half of a career in the English department I taught in, but not after the political correctness and multiple diversity and so forth started taking form. And it was impossible to argue about or against, say, multiculturalism without being attacked as anti any race that might be involved or any type or ethnicity that might be involved. And so there was a closed-mindedness that the invention and spreading of this divide-and-conquer system, there was a closed-mindedness already waiting there for it to be preyed on. And that's what I can't forgive, that the American intellectuals in English departments across the country had let themselves get dumbed down to the point or uninterested to the point where they were easily victimized by this.
Yeah, I saw some of that in the African literature department where I got my PhD.
Uh-huh.
The sort of hangover of reading everything strictly politically from a liberation narrative kind of perspective or autobiographical oppressed person perspective,
it sort of
leveled out the whole corpus of African literature, and it was almost politically incorrect to point out that there were some writers like Wole Soyinka and J.M. Coetzee and Ngugi wa Thiong'o at his best, and of course Naguib Mahfouz in Egypt. These people are really, really amazing writers from this, you know, the whole perspective of doing something important with language
and writing about all of life, not just one tiny part of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Mahfouz, of course, is famous for that.
Exactly.
For covering the whole thing, and putting those things sort of on the same level of vastly inferior works that everybody had to read as part of the corpus, and all, you know, almost all those inferior works are sort of political chip on your shoulder autobiography.
That's right.
So you see that we've lost something from the ability to critique culture honestly.
This is the biggest thing. It's a little bit of a chicken and the egg question as to whether who preyed on who, or was it because they were ready to be preyed on, or was it because they were preyed on that they became so narrow? But I lost an entire literary way of being, a whole literary vocabulary, a whole sense of the importance of the arts in and of themselves. People would, I just became a loner. And so I wrote this whole book about it. But guess what? Not only, I thought that my ex-colleagues and then others in departments of English across the country would lambaste the book and pick it up and get all hot and argue, and that it'd be great opening of doors and windows. Oh no. Silence.
Hmm.
Silence. And not even the conservatives would touch it. I knew Heather McDonald down at the Manhattan Institute, so I sent her a copy and urged her and said, she's a big shot in education and so forth too. She never even wrote back.
Now, are you talking about A Nation Gone Blind?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know what you'd think of something like the end of the 19th century. I've been reading some of it here on the screen as I'm talking with you, and I know, I don't understand. There are different kinds of writing, and there's plenty of room in the world for all of them. And there's writing that sweeps you up and that goes fast and is adventuresome and adventurous, and there's writing that isn't. But I wish that they could be. Wasn't that a phrase from the 50s? A word, cohabitate, for Russia and the U.S. I think it was.
I think your novel is interesting in that it's paced in a way that, that fits with its theme. And, you know, it, it does, it, you know, you had some of these rave rejections, you know, bring up names like Proust and
yeah.
Joyce.
Yeah.
And both Proust and Joyce really did almost their most important work looking back at a certain reality of the 19th century, or in Joyce's case, I guess Bloomsday happened in 1904 in Ulysses, but they were writing a little later, looking back at a vanished reality that was identified with the 19th century, and the 20th century is becoming more and more unreal. We're losing our European culture has lost its bearings.
I wonder if you're not absolutely right, and that's a really frightening thing, because you don't know, you know, then art will just collapse into propaganda, and that's all there will be left.
Well, there are different ways, though, of addressing this. You've done one by, you know, this, your book is a wonderful evocation of this vanished American reality. It awoke all sorts of memories in me. You know, I was
good.
I grew up in the Midwest too.
Yeah.
And you know, you're this city, you know, that you're describing, and the house and the neighborhood, and it's all, you know, very weirdly familiar. I mean, even the spinster aunts that you describe. I mean, I had these two spinster aunts who lived in Minnesota, probably not very far from where your book is set.
Probably not.
It's so there's a, you know, an amazing sort of sense of place being evoked there, but the pacing is so different from what we're used to reading now in this rush kind of age.
Yeah, that's true. My third novel, this is the third one, my second novel, my brother-in-law read it and called me up on the phone. He was very excited. He just really had liked it a great deal. And one of the questions he's very, very serious when he gets into a thing like this. You know, he's kind of a new, his mind is quite sequential. And so he'll come out with a question, and then he'll answer it. And I'll say, okay, and then this one. And one of his questions was, why no dialogue? And I told him the answer is that I don't want to write plays on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it's going to survive as a unique genre, I don't think, I mean, at least part of it, the one arm of it, at least, the one tentacle of prose fiction, can't just be based still on the stage, proscenium stage. And so,
that's an interesting observation, and it leads me to remember that Mike Polachek's book, Guests of the Nation, actually, what, you know, Mike, it kind of does, you know, almost nothing but dialogue. You know, really good.
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of dialogue, but, and you're the exact opposite.
Yeah, but his is so powerful visually.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I hear the music.
Okay, here's the music. Right. We shall return at the other end of the music. So this is Kevin Vera talking with Eric Larson. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Dynamic Duo Show right here on GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking a little bit of literature along with the politics today with Eric Larson. He's the author of The End of the 19th Century. And, you know, if you want to understand what's happened to the USA in the last 100 years, you could do worse than reading Eric Larson's work as sort of one bookend, and the dystopian science fiction of Philip K. Dick on the other end of the bookshelf. And that's kind of, I think, where we've gone as a nation.
It's interesting. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I'm not ever trying to make an argument that there's got to be one kind of prose fiction or prose narrative that's better than all others. I'm not arguing that, never will. But that kind of a pairing of quite disparate types of approach and quite different, you know, disparate views and visions. It's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, telling the truth about the world we inhabit is a very, very difficult task, and, you know, there are different approaches to it. Philip Dick was forced to do what he did because he couldn't make a living writing mainstream fiction.
Yeah.
And he could sell science fiction novels. He became the first American writer to actually live on his earnings, such as they were from science fiction. He did have to eat dog food or horse meat from the dog food store for a while. But, And you've had some problems publishing good mainstream fiction yourself.
I certainly have. This one is an 11-year wait, so.
Yeah.
You know, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. This thing about trying to write about what's real and tell the truth. My definition of writing has been for about close to 25 years now when I finally thought it through. And my definition is any art, if it's going to be true to itself and it's going to succeed, it's and I use the verbal version of the definition because I'm talking about narrative mainly. But so writing is telling the truth about life in a way that's itself also true. So you know, you tell the truth in a way that's not itself just phony. And it's really a tough.
Well, it is, because language becomes phony in just being reused. You find yourself constantly mouthing platitudes and words from other people's mouths, and getting it right and you know, having it real as it comes out of your mouth or out of your fingertips or your pen.
That's true.
It's not easy.
And also when types of writing become imitative of previous types, then that's another kind of not being true. The method isn't true. You know, when it's too derivative.
Right.
Of earlier writers. So one of the things that I've done, I have to say, that I like best is something that I despise the most and put off the longest. And that was before A Nation Gone Blind came out. I was asked, in fact, I was required, basically, to write a self-interview about me and the book. And it was a con job because it wasn't supposed to be revealed that it was me interviewing me.
Wait, who required you to do this?
Well,
the thought police?
Yes, right. You know, the thought police, a.k.a. my publisher.
yeah, okay. I got
there
that,
you
right.
go. I mean, it's getting pretty bad, isn't it? So I put it off because I found it distasteful. Finally, the pressure was increasing as pub date came closer, and I wrote a piece, and it was really hard work, and it came out very well. Because I was able to ask myself the questions that were most interesting to me. And one of the questions is, this so-called interrogator asks about writing, and I give them that definition. And so then the interrogator says, well, tell the truth about what? And so the answer is, well, about the nature of life in a state of existence, of course. That's all that art has ever been about. You know, to tell the truth about the state of being alive in existence, and that it sounds stupid. It sounds frivolous, perhaps. It sounds like too narrow a kind of definition, or maybe just some pseudo philosophic thing. But to me, that's it. People, I want art of all the kinds there are to make people aware that they're alive, not just in the sense that they're excited, but in any sense. Art's got to be about being alive. That's a real subject. I think. Well, do you agree with that at all?
I do agree with that. I think that one other element that's mixed in there, though, is the ludic or playful element. That art is basically a form of play. A very, you know, and play, of course, is actually more serious than real life. In your book, for example, you've sort of recreated this place and this time in such a serious, intense way. It sort of reminds me of, you know, a bright, imaginative child creating an imaginary or an alternative reality with great intensity, you know, and you have to have that sort of playful quality or ludic quality to what you're doing, I think, to really make it rise to the level of art. And that's hard to do, I think, in tough circumstances like right now, you know, trying to do this with regard to 9/11. It's so painful. How do you get playful about it?
Well, here, I mean, I put the kid in the first chapter when he says he learns he's going to become a student of the mysteries of space and time. And when he has this incredible epiphany that unites him with the entire world around him, he's sitting on the toilet having a BM. and that has a role that occurs later. There's another go-round of that same theme. And I get this mainly from Jonathan Swift, whom I'm a great lover of. But, you know, I try to tell the story of being one with life, with all those tendrils, you know, that go out in the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But then the terrible, terrible real subject is the loss of that life and the place and the nation. I mean, it's dedicated. The dedication page says, for our dying nation. And I couldn't help myself but put that there because it's that serious. But you know, the pictures, I don't know if you want to, if you ever look ahead in books, but the last two pictures for me are the ones that, that pretty well tell the whole story.
You know, I haven't thus.
Yeah, it's up to you. My wife hates me because I always look at the end of a book first.
Yeah, I've been known to do that, but I haven't yet done that with yours yet.
You know, I haven't seen a copy of the book myself yet. I'm waiting, and they're kind of slow getting their, my copy to me. So.
Well, I'm actually reading the PDF, which people can doubt. Should we tell them that they're allowed to get it for free?
Oh, absolutely, sure. That's why it's there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's at your website, ericlarsen.net, L-A-R-S-E-N. .net. The End of the 19th Century is the book. And, you know, Eric, your newsletter is also something that my listeners might be interested in. I think you're my most serious competition as a 9/11 truth person putting out a generally pretty readable, informative newsletter. And I hate to admit it, but stylistically, I think you do better than I do on a regular basis.
Kevin, I'm not even, it's not really even a newsletter. You know, it's my, in my case, if I get a piece up and ready to go on, then I put an email that introduces it and hopes to lure people into reading it. But it's nothing like your coverage or nothing like your, the variety that you provide.
Well, we're kind of doing slightly different things, but your newsletter is really good. I highly recommend it. People need to go to ericlarsen.net and sign up for it right now. If you want to come to Kevin Barrett, Barrett for Congress.us, you can get on my list too, and you could do worse than subscribing to these two newsletters, especially Eric's.
Especially Kevin's. Well, it's wonderful talking with you. I hope the book finds its readers. I think it will. We were just talking about publishing, and John Leonard is in agreement with an editor that my wife was talking about just recently, talking with, and his position is that book publication has got, in order to get serious again and financially, feasible, it's got to begin with electronic publication like this,
right?
Like print on demand, and then if there's a demand, then it can go to offset print.
Right.
But if people run even a print run of 2,000 tiny, and they sell 400, I mean, they're left with a huge liability.
Right.
And, A Nation Gone Blind still hasn't sold 4,000.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
It's funny. You know, I saw it in a really prominent display rack in the Borders bookstore here in Madison, Wisconsin. So I thought it was maybe doing better than that.
Oh, did you see it? Was that very recent or?
No, this was, I think it was last year, at least a year ago. But yeah, it was very prominently displayed. There was a whole like wall of them on this rack. Whoa, Eric must be rolling in the dough.
No, I wish. Yeah, I think the problem is that the demand, I don't know. They don't reorder, that's it, I guess. But we'll trudge on, won't we?
American culture isn't quite dead yet.
No, not with you and me around. Not with the likes of us still hollering.
All right. Well, okay. Hey, thanks, Eric. It's been great as always.
Thank you, too. Same.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Eric Larsen of ericlarsen.net, L-A-R-S-E-N.net. And I'm Kevin Barrett of barrettforcongress.us. Be back on Monday with more great radio. So until then, have a really good weekend, and see you all in a bit.